Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and that's I Need a Beat. LL Cool J. James Todd Smith. The real name of LL Cool J, born on this day in 1968. That's what his mother called him. But here we are. Welcome back here to the Mark Steiner Show. On our way to a conversation, I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to testing, you can learn about the critical issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. And now we turn to our monthly segment, If You Were Mayor. And in the issue that appeared, the last city paper issue, not the one out today, but last week's, a bunch of people wrote the New Year's resolutions that had to do with the city that we live in. I wrote one, and three of the people sitting in the studio also wrote one. And we're going to talk about their thoughts of what they would do if they were mayor, how these pieces they wrote might fit together or not fit together. Hear your thoughts at 410-319-8888. What would you do if you were mayor right now? Give us a call, 410-319-8888. Write to us here, talk at steinershow.org. Or if you are a tweeter, tweet me at Mark Steiner. I'm here with Dr. Lester Spence, Center for Emerging Media Scholar in Residence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University. David Troy, CEO and co-founder of 410 Labs, creator of Maelstrom.
Maelstrom.
Maelstrom. And Dee Watkins, author and filmmaker, Coppin State University, creative writing professor. Good to have the three of you with us.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
410-319-8888, give us your thoughts. This is interesting things that you all wrote. And I'm wondering, you know, as we write about them, we have a city that... There's a body of people in our city who think that the city is moving forward, that a lot of very cool and good things are happening, that businesses are coming in, that you've got major businesses who are founded and created, making all kinds of athletic wear in this town. They don't make it here, but they're here. And Under Armour, that all these things are going on, and the city is really moving ahead, that younger families are moving into downtown Baltimore and South Baltimore and Fells Point and other communities, East Baltimore, and those usually mean white families are moving into, young white families are moving in. We're seeing Station North Arts saying this is where the future is. So what's your assessment, given the things that you wrote? I mean, and some people say the city is a very divided town. Then we're not together at all. That this is about part of our community, not all of our community. David, you haven't been on the air on my show in at least 10 years. Why don't you start?
Yeah, it's been at least a couple.
Good to have you here.
Yeah, you know, I think that it is fair to say that the city is moving forward, but with an asterisk. It's not moving forward for everybody, and it's not moving forward as quickly as I think that it should. I think that one of the things that's a real problem is that we don't really have a sense that our government is really accountable and that there's, you know, a lot of spending that goes on and a lot of fraud, waste, and abuse that's continually reported on that I think that we could do a better job with handling. And it's not just to recover, you know, the few dollars that we could save from doing audits, which I think, you know, that could be substantial savings. But it's also to set the tone, that the government cares about accountability and that we care about moving the city forward in an accountable way. And I think when you do that, you attract a lot more investment that can help move more people forward more fairly. And I think that that's super important right now.
Dr. Spence.
So if you take something like Station North, right, I spend a lot of time in Station North and know a lot of the stakeholders and people who hang out there personally, good folk. You can make an argument that that represents Baltimore at its best. Right, it's open, it's cultural, it's sophisticated, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing is, the Station North isn't created without, at the same time, without exclusion, right? So what's going on is we're defining progress in a way that, by definition, causes poor, predominantly black populations in Baltimore to be left out. And where I think I disagree a bit with David is I don't think markets or investment is the solution to that. I think that's a political problem where I think where we've articulated the cities, Baltimore, Philly, Detroit, et cetera, as a place that works best when investors can put money in it as opposed to articulating a city in a different way. And I think those visions are, they can potentially overlap, but right now they're excluded. So to that extent, I don't think Baltimore is moving forward at all.
I kind of agree with both guys here because And you as well, and what you said in the beginning. I think Baltimore is moving forward in a lot of ways, but then it's also the same place. I say forward because, you know, Amazon, Under Armour, they're creating jobs. Like, people are getting jobs, but this is 2004, which is good because, you know, you want to take care of your family and you want to be able to make a living. But it's 2014, and I still know black people that don't know white people. I know black people that don't. When I was growing up, I didn't know any white people. So, and I think I talk about that in my two Baltimore's essay. Like, I don't know. You know, I didn't grow up knowing, you know, other than like housing police and a couple of teachers. So, going back to, or just I guess bridging that to my resolution is, I think one of the major things is just communication. Even if we are going to live in separate neighborhoods, we still should be able to see each other as humans and be able to communicate at a high level. And that's due to literacy. You know, people aren't reading. They aren't developing complex thoughts, and we aren't bridging those gaps between these communities. Once we bridge those gaps between those communities, then social relations and racial relations will change. And, you know, this would be one big happy, the whole city look like a big happy diversity flyer or something.
Well, let me tackle some of this because it came out of your essay and a little bit about that. You don't know how I'm pointing to David Troy. Your essay, David Troy, and something that I wrote as well. And I can't, we can't read this quote verbatim that you put in your essay, D. Watkins, but you gave Sherman Alexie quotes, but I guess on the show many times, I can say it without using the words he used. But he said, rich people who don't read, we are
A-holes.
A-holes, thank you. And poor people who don't read are screwed.
Yeah.
So, and I think that there's a lot of truth in that quote by Sherman Alexie. Yep. A lot of truth. And I think what you just said about and I want to get back to this, which is don't kind of think with complexity if you don't really read and getting it in something. It's a very important point. I'm going to come back to it. I think that can be a show on itself by itself because I think it's a very powerful idea about how we get complexity in the minds of our young people.
I'm free tomorrow.
But okay. Tomorrow. Okay. And so before we get to the phones to Walton and before I get to Jenny's thing on Facebook she sent us, what about the way we talk about this racial divide? I mean, you talked about this in your piece, David Troy, thinking that black and white in Baltimore need to come together, that there needs to be kind of a more unity in this town. And I think that, and I know Lester, having spoken to some of these things before on this program, has a little different idea about how that might work. But let's lay that out here for our listeners. So I think it's an important discussion to have. And you laid it out a bit in your piece, talking about how you sit in two worlds. D. Watkins, because you grew up in the housing projects, so you go home to that all the time and hang out with people who you grew up with, but you've also crossed in this world of the kind of scene of the literati, much of which is, not all of which, but a huge portion is white, at least the stuff that the folks that get out there and are seen mostly in public, by the public media, I should say. Mm-hmm. So let's wrestle with this. David, why don't you lay out your thesis, then I'm going to go right to Lester, okay?
Yeah, sure. So one of the things that I've been doing for the last 3 years or so is studying the social networks in Baltimore using a variety of different tools, mostly data generated from online social networks, things like Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn, things like that. And one of the things that you discover, particularly when you look at, say, data from Twitter, is that there are two Baltimores, and it's very clearly documented in terms of how that functions and who's on what side and where information flows and where information doesn't flow. And in comparing that data to other cities, you can see that Baltimore is a more divided city than just about anywhere else. Now, I know a lot of people are probably thinking you don't need to be a rocket scientist to figure that out. You can walk around on the street and get a pretty good sense of that. But I think that what the social science is starting to tell us for real, and you know, we can look at real studies that point to this, is that this kind of divided network is very unhealthy. And I think we get a sense of that walking around on the street too. So what you could start to do is to use this kind of information to start to think about ways to bridge the gap. And like what Dee was saying, you know, I think it's super important that we all get to know each other more because, you know, like he said, there's a lot of folks, kind of in white Baltimore that don't know very many black folks. So the few that they do are, you know, they have a very similar experience to their own. So I think, you know, what I'm kind of proposing is how do we figure out a way to use information and to use our intellect to figure out ways to cross the divides in a more intentional way and to ultimately heal those divides and move us forward together as a united city.
And I think that there's a stat that we use in the show, another conversation, that only 10% of white Americans have friends who are black. Friends. not just people you pass in the night.
So I'm going to bracket my statements by saying that I'm pushing against this idea, but I mean I can feel it, right? So the listeners don't. I know D not as D Watkins, not as a primarily as a writer. I've been playing basketball with him at Hopkins for the last several years, yeah. Right? We play Wednesday, Friday at this time. Usually.
Thank you all for coming.
Basketball is real important. Basketball is like life. And there are a range of us who have very different backgrounds, very different, and we literally leave all that stuff on the court. We have astrophysicists, professors, students, folks, just neighborhood folks playing, right? And we're just interacting, and it's a beautiful thing when it works well, right? So, but with that said, right, and the work that David is doing is incredibly important. I've seen his TED Talks. I think it's incredibly important. But with that said, what we're talking about is not primarily a function of people who consume different types of mediums, for example, people who consume hip-hop versus people who consume country. What we're talking about is the function of a political economy, right? Housing policies that over time have tended to shunt poor black people in one area, tended to send them in schools that tend to generate certain types of labor opportunities, and then do the opposite for whites, right? And that's something that we could miss if we focus solely on the types of individual level interactions that would cause me and D would have got along anyway, but me and D to get along with the people we play ball with when D doesn't whine. And then and for me and David to have encounters. D's a lot better basketball player than I am, but he whines more.
He whines more.
He whines more.
I wouldn't take that, D.
You're better than both. Both are better than I am, I'll tell you.
Well, jump in.
So, going back to public policy or going back to investor relations in general, is one thing I can say is I'm a freelance adjunct professor. I'm one guy. I have, when it comes to big financial capital and things like that, I don't have a lot of power to change policy. Yeah. I don't have a lot of power. I can't walk into, certain places and make them, consider my idea. I'm not a power guy. But what I can do, and there's a quote, I don't know who said it, but I like it a lot, is don't let your inability to do everything undermine your ability to do anything. So with the power that I have, with some of the articles I write and some of the speaking engagements that I do, I've been able to make instant change. So going back to like the whole My resolution is, I was just telling the guys in the lobby before the show that it's not really just a revolution, a New Year's resolution. It's a lifestyle. It's a lifestyle that I've adapted and that I'm very, very happy with. So, I can't, control construction in Station North. I can't go ahead. I can't sit down and toss ideas back and forth with Stephanie Rollins Blake. But my essays go viral in high schools. Kids hit me up every day talking about, they want it right now. People who don't understand black people at all email me all of the time with their updated perspectives on basic humanity in general. Okay, so I listen to country music, you listen to hip hop, but they're both lyrically dense and filled with pain. This is the human level. This is why people connect to them. This is what we share. So even though we approach these things differently and culturally we're different, at the core, we're the same, and literacy helps break down those communication barriers and allows us to have those conversations. Because if you're broke and you don't really have a lot of money and you can't, afford yourself the opportunity to have these experiences, you can pick up a book and you can learn. You can see how Faulkner sees the world. You can see how Hemingway sees the world. You can read about James Baldwin. You can read all these amazing people and their perspectives, and then you can develop your own and you'll be a more enlightened person. So I'm able to take nothing, I have nothing, and I've been able to turn it into something, and I'm content with that, and Lester's right. I am probably the best basketball player there, but I try to chill youngest. Because I want the astrophysicists and those guys to feel comfortable too. I don't want to be an a-hole.
Not the best, better than me, a lot better. So this is what I appreciate. So I didn't talk about what my resolution was. What my resolution was, real quick, was it was about counting bullets, right? So the hashtag, if we could boil down 2014 into one phrase, the most important phrase, not just of 2014, I'd go back at least 10 years, before, maybe even before 9/11. I'd say Black Lives Matter. Right, Black Lives Matter. And the reason that hashtag becomes important is became important is because not just because there are these flare-ups where police were killing these unarmed black kids, right? It was that a couple of, I think, trans black women came up with that hashtag as a way to articulate, right? Right? So it's like, okay, the power of that idea. Now, ideas can go viral. Ideas can go viral, and they can change the world. There is no way that Gandhi had a conception when he was organizing and developing nonviolent principles in India that some decades later, this pastor and group of folks in Alabama on the other side of the Atlantic would take these ideas and fundamentally transform democracy, right? So to that extent, I appreciate David and Dee. Because their ideas are really transforming the way we understand reality. What I'm simply suggesting is that it's important that at least somebody articulate politics and put politics first and foremost in idea generation so somebody can see that, can read this piece that I said, okay, wow, why don't we count bullets, right? If we count all this stuff, if we use metrics to evaluate how good a government spends its money, if we use metrics to figure out how good teachers are, how good schools are, why don't we use metrics to hold police more accountable? In Germany, I think in 2012, 85 bullets were shot total.
A country of 40 million people.
Right. Now, we don't even know how many bullets. We don't even know how many bullets the Baltimore Police Department bought.
85
much less
Tuesday.
Shot. Right. Exactly. Straight up. Right.
Yeah.
Right. So that's a mechanism that if we knew it, we could actually, as a democratic body of citizens, place control, say, you know what? You shot like X thousand bullets. You guys should cut that number down. Right. I mean, and I don't have any more power than D does to make that change. But just like D and David have the power of communication, you use a venue to put it out there, and then it's going to hit somebody with the idea that it's going to hit somebody. It does.
So
I just want to loop back around on that.
And then I'm going to open the phones because Walton's been waiting on. Other people have been waiting.
Cool. Yeah,
Go ahead.
I mean, the idea that you know, we should be counting bullets, I think, is awesome, and I think we should be counting everything. I think that, you know, this notion that we run this city with really little to no accountability, and that one of the preconditions of sort of becoming part of the political machinery is that we stop paying attention to things like that. We turn a blind eye to all kinds of things. That's totally unacceptable. That has to change.
Yeah.
So, folks, what do you think? If you remember, these ideas coming out, and they're really incredible essays these three men have written and the other people who wrote on this period on the city paper, really all of them kind of deep think about where a city can go. And I think that it lends itself to the idea that there are creative – that the city is not being managed in a creative way that also is a creative way that has substance. And I think that that's what we're talking about here, is finding different ways of managing a city and making it go forward, given the complexities that we have. 410-319-8888 is the number. Walton, you're on the air. Walton, you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can. There's some little – yeah, we got you. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you for having me. And I wasn't waiting too long. I was enjoying the conversation.
Good.
And that really is a good segue to my point. I think one of the major issues that the mayor is not addressing is accountability. And we know basic principles of math that when you have an unbalanced equation, the result is not good. And what I mean by that is that accountability for both police officers and citizens in Baltimore. I do believe that the police officers should wear body cameras so that if you're really living up to the principles that you took the oath for, then yeah, you shouldn't have a problem being accountable to something that you signed on for. But also accountability to the citizens for the crimes and illegal offenses that they commit. Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book called The Tipping Point, along with other books.
Right.
And there was a segment in there where he talked about, I believe it may have been New York, how they got rid of crime, how the crime had just tipped over and boiled over, but then all of a sudden it just died down. And what happened was that they made little changes. They enforced the laws or enforced the penalties for the little crimes, things like loitering and littering and things like that, panhandling. And when you let people get away with little things, then it feel more apt to go after big things and commit even bigger offenses. I think that Baltimore, the legal system really has to hold people accountable for the little things, because the little things will segue into big things. The loitering, you know, the curfews, all of these laws are in place and on the books, but nobody's really enforcing them. I'm a native of Baltimore, and I've lived in East Baltimore, Northwest Baltimore, Northeast Baltimore, West Baltimore, and I see, you know, I drive through the city at different hours in the night, and I see a lot of infractions to these laws, and people are just getting away with it.
Right.
You got people standing on a corner, you got people throwing trash everywhere and doing whatever they want to do, loitering and littering, panhandling, and nobody's holding them accountable.
Let me let our panelists kind of respond. I hear what you're saying. I think there's a body of thought about that that's very deep in Baltimore, and let me go over to Lester than to David. Your thoughts on this first, and then to D.
I think the broken windows policy he's talking about is an excellent example of the power of an idea. A couple of social scientists write an essay in The Atlantic, I think approximately 20 years ago, arguing that if you reduce, you know, broken windows are a sign of chaos, if you deal with that. The only problem with it is, and it's kind of a big one, is there actually is no data that the crime in New York or anywhere that policy is applied has actually reduced crime in those areas. When we've got crime reduction, it comes from another source. What does tend to happen when we have broken windows policing is two things. One is we have increased negative interactions between police and citizens that lead to the deaths that cause something like Black Lives Matter. And then the second thing is that we increasingly, one of the things that Baltimore and part of making cities like Baltimore more investment friendly is they reduce the tax burdens at the top. But they still have to collect revenue somewhere, right? So what they do is they use policing as a way to collect revenue. And as we see in New York City, the New York City police officers are doing a work stoppage. The city's losing approximately $10 million a month because they're stopping. They're no longer ticketing for things that they shouldn't be ticketing for, like loitering. And de Blasio, who's supposed to be the right guy for the mayor, has said, we need that money back, so you need to get back on the job. That's an example of an idea gone bad.
Yeah, I think I agree. I mean, I think that, first the caller's idea that, you know, people should be accountable and that we should create a culture of accountability and responsibility in the city is certainly one that no one can argue with. I think that, you know, that's definitely something that we want to have. But we have tried this idea of kind of, you know, enforcing these petty crimes and whatnot. And what it just ends up with is a great deal of burden for the police department worrying about small things as opposed to the bigger things that are actually going to have an effect on, let's say, the murder rate and things like that. So, you know, I want to say that I think that well-intentioned idea is perhaps also obfuscated a little bit by Gladwell, who has a tendency to say, let's mix up correlation with causality. I would argue that the reason why crime ultimately tipped over in New York was because of massive investment into the city over the course of the 90s in particular, and that once you reach a certain point, you know, there was just you started to shift the entire culture of the city. So I think, you know, there's good ideas in there that we can pick out and move forward in terms of you know, creating that kind of culture. But I think we want to be careful not to just buy onto one particular ideology that seems like it's a simple answer.
And I think we have to go to break here, and we'll come right back to Dee to Lamech, our next caller, and to reading Kelly's piece that she sent in on the web that we'll read as well. And just as we go out here, the thing about it, these are one of the things that I was trying to get to in my essay, which is by creating something in communities that is like getting people more involved in the life of the neighborhoods people live in. By creating things like, this might sound silly to some people, but I really think it might work, a volunteer fire department that works alongside professionals, where people who live in the community are actually taking care of their community. And that also begins to take care of the loitering and the littering and more because people are involved and don't want these things happening. Mm-hmm. Or a real civilian patrol that works with people in the community to tap down the violence, to be able to talk to people, to expand things like safe streets so that people have people who can go out there who understand the street, have been through it, come out of prison, want to make a difference, can counsel people and change stuff, yeah. Stop the violence and help people get the houses fixed. I mean, these are things we can do creatively from the bottom up that can change the way we think about our city. But we, you know, that are long term and not these kind of quick little fixes that we always do. But take a break and think about that more. We're going to come back to our listeners. Lamech, you called in, and we go to our Facebook page. And of course, we're not going to forget Dee, who didn't get a chance to come in this last one. We're going to break with, and you guess who that is? The Supremes, Buttered Popcorn. This day in 1970, they played their final show with Diana Ross. What do you like? He made you know what I like.
me again, kiss me, my darling. Each time I cling to your kiss, I hear music divine. Bésame mucho.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and that's Bésame Mucho by Caterina Valente. The great Italian singer, guitarist, and actress Caterina Valente was born on this day in 1931. And we are here with three people on our panel, none of whom were born in 1931. D. Watkins, author and filmmaker, Coppin State University creative writing professor, David Troy, CEO and co-founder of 410 Labs, and Dr. Liz Spence, of course, associate professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University, and you at 410-319-8888. You have a quick thought, D, before we go back to the phones?
Sure.
What we just said?
Here's an idea. Let's stop making opportunity exclusive. You know, if you want a reduction in crime, let's stop making opportunity exclusive. No one wants to be a criminal. People don't break the law because they think it's cool. Or people don't dive into a life of crime because it seems like the fun thing to do. They do it because they don't have any opportunity. If you really, really, really want to be serious about, you know, a reduction in crime, you know, because a lot of times people talk about governments and systems and making these changes. And at the end of the day, it's the same system. You know, if you fire a cop like a Darren Wilson, there's millions of Darren Wilsons on the police force who, you know, who don't feel like they need to be accountable for the things they do. And it all leads back to the communication, which leads back to the reason why things are the way they are. So, you know, it's all based on opportunity. People do these things because they don't have opportunity. And then, you know, we can twist the system. We can change it. We can alter it. We can try to do this and do that. But the same thing's going to happen. And the people are going to break the law when they can't do nothing else. And that's not a white thing or a black thing. It's a desperation thing.
410-319-8888. Let's go to Lamech on the east side. You're on the air.
Yeah. First of all, I thank you for being here. This is a great show.
Thank you.
First time I called.
Welcome.
I just want to make 2 points. The first point is we really got to make sure these guys don't give any hard fouls in this basketball game that they
play. He's plotting on me, man. He's giving me the side out.
You got enough coverage. My second point is I like what they're saying, but it's unfortunate that we are still coming from all the same perspective. I think if you want to be integrationalist in a time like this, when we getting shot down in the street, okay, so be it. That's fine. You know, if you want to do that, that's okay. But to hang our success based upon how we integrate with these people, I'm not sure about that, okay? Like, I believe in looking at things for what they are. You know, we got to stop looking through. And I'm not picking on these guys because I follow D. Watkins on Twitter. You know what I'm saying? We rapped a couple times. He probably don't even know, but yeah, whatever. But what I'm saying is we cannot come from that perspective of where if we want to integrate, fine, but we got to use it to our advantage. We can't base our success based upon how we integrate with people that are killing us. I think that's fair. That's it.
All right. Well, Mike, thank you so much. Let's talk about that because, I mean, he's getting to the heart of some of the issues that folks have with this notion of crossing these lines racially. What does that really mean?
We kind of don't really have a choice because the world is already mixed. Like we already are going to be interacting with each other anyway. So it's kind of the only direction that we can go in right now is just having the ability to try to not assimilate to the dominant culture, but join and unite and maintain our own distinctive neighborhoods and our own ideas or our own, you know, way of life, but at the same time understand them and have them be able to understand us, because it's not the world, you know, it's already going down. Even though Baltimore's divided, you still are forced to interact with different people. So, you know, it's no way around that. So the best thing to do is to try to enhance those relations and show each other how we're both humans and that we need to just how coexisting at a higher level will make a better way of life for all of us.
So, and what does it mean for this panel of people and our listeners out there, 410-319-8888, and write to us here, talk@steinershow.org. I mean, is it important for Baltimore to cross over racially? And what does that even mean? And what has to do with political power? And how does that say, I mean, if you just take a look at this, if you talk about Station North Arts, right now we're seeing this beautiful gentrification, this development of this area, but will it be an area like this in Howard Street for both black and white artists, for both black and white residents, for poor working class people and wealthy people to live together? Or will it be a white artistic community where most of the people have money because they can afford the studios? I mean, what is it? I'm saying, so how does this all fit into this question of race across our city? David, you raised it in your piece first. I'm going to let you go and then come back.
Yeah, I mean, I think first I want to express respect for the caller's perspective in that I think that, you know, the notion that you wait around for something to happen, you know, and you can't be successful until this magical sort of integration with everybody occurs and we're all singing Kumbaya, that's fair. You know, I think that there is kind of the, you know, the notion of now, and I think that that's important. But I think at the same time, you know, we're all going to succeed and we're all going to fail together in Baltimore, you know, together. We're going to do this thing together. And the direction that things are going in, I think that you can make a strong argument that it is equally unhealthy for the folks in, say, the white community and, say, in the, you know, sort of one end of the spectrum as it is for the folks on the far other end of the spectrum. This isn't good for any of us the way this is. And if you actually look at the social science on this, there's an interesting book called Social Physics by a guy at MIT that talks about how social networks work, not just in humans, but in other organisms as well. And whenever you have this kind of distinct separateness that is sort of fiercely suspicious of the other part of the network, you have an unhealthy situation, and it has cross-generational effects. It can even affect the brain development of folks in the extreme ends of the network to the point where they're not interested in exploring the other parts of the network. And so you can make a very strong scientific case that, you know, this is not a healthy configuration that we're in right now. So, you know, while I do certainly respect the notion that, you know, there shouldn't be a condition for success, there shouldn't be some sort of, you know, predefined notion of what it means in order for everybody to be able to move forward, we are going to have to move forward together, and we can create a much healthier, much stronger city by unlocking the potential of relationships between us all.
What does that mean for you, Lester?
Well,
what does that reality mean?
Yeah. I believe that cities like Baltimore, I said this before in the show many times, I believe cities like Baltimore and Detroit that are majority black, I think everyone has to kind of wrestle with living in a majority black city, and they have to claim Black Lives Matter. In this case, I think we have people with slightly different ideological perspectives, but I don't think any of the ideas that any of us have proposed actually precludes the notion of black people using these mechanisms to kind of figure out what it is that they want to do or what it is they should do. I mean, certainly in the case of the getting high school kids to communicate, we're talking about Baltimore public school system, with the exception of a couple of schools, is majority black, by like 85% majority black. We're talking about getting black kids to communicate. In the case of the police stuff, you know, learning how to hold police accountable, you're talking about, not only are we talking about giving those skills to a majority black citizenry, the people doing the most organizing on the ground to deal with this issue is Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, and that's a black nationalist organization. So I'd simply say that there are a number of arguments we can make for black nationalist approaches, and there isn't necessarily a hard and fast distinction between black nationalist approaches and other approaches as far as the technologies we're talking about and the resolutions we're talking about today.
But okay, D.
No, you know, I just think, you know, we benefit more by connecting. Just being divided, you know, is we just leaving too much opportunity on the table.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like, I mean, I haven't known you that long, but I've bounced ideas off of you, and you know, and have inspired me in different ways. That's the power of people from different worlds who are also from the same world communicating and things happening at high levels. We, you know, now how we get there is, you know, is what all of us are challenged with, and what we think about and what we write about and what we dream about and what we try to create. But, you know, we together would be better than, you know, all of us digging into our own little pockets, because we're robbing ourselves of exposure, ideas, creativity, and, you know, and just the idea, or just to put it out there, I don't know if everyone should know this, but race isn't really anything but an idea. Doesn't even exist. You can have more as a black person. I can have more genetically in common with a white person, you know, than the black person sitting across from me. It's just an idea.
I mean, I would say that racism, unfortunately, is kind of a real social system. But I think racism.
I mean, the idea of race is just an idea.
The whole notion of race, period, is 500 years old. Never existed before. There was nobody even thought about race before this. And the Smithsonian and National Geographic had their little pictures of Negroid people and Coscoid people and Australoid people. And, you know, and it's just that creating these gaps, that this whole false notion. But the racism we face, I think, in this society, and the structural racism, is very real. Why? Like in your world or the tech world, the ownership of most of the tech world, there's a very little black ownership inside the tech world.
Especially in Silicon Valley.
Right? Yeah. Or even in Baltimore City?
No, even in Baltimore City.
Right?
Too.
So let me go back to the phones here. Let me read this piece. Jenny Dill wrote in to Facebook, I would get rid of all the city-owned cars being driven by employees whose jobs don't require frequent travel. It's a huge waste of the taxpayer dollars. Many of these vehicles are used by mostly office workers, driven to and from out-of-city residences, and they are parked all over downtown Baltimore during the day, taking up parking spaces for visitors, workers, and tourists, depriving the city of parking fees. But this is just one thing. There is much yet to do. So, and let's go back to phones of 410-319-8888. Mike in North Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hey, Mark, how are you?
Very well, welcome.
And greetings, Lester, Dee, and Dave. I know.
Hey, what's up, Mike? You're supposed to be on the court. What are you doing?
I played basketball with these gentlemen, and I can tell you, unqualified, Dee is better than Lester.
This is a b-ball day here. Isn't it?
Yeah, I tell the truth.
He's a journalist, so you got to listen to him.
they are both better than me. I am a journalist. I've interviewed Dave Troy. Dave, how are you?
Hey, how are you?
Great conversation, guys, and so important. The thing I want to add here is I'd love to steer this conversation, you know, for 40 minutes. You know, we've been talking about, you know, the fact that, you know, black Baltimore and white Baltimore, you know, kind of separate worlds, need to know each other better. And really, no one can disagree with that, but how do we get there, right? Like, concretely, what are the concrete things that you and I and, you know, people living in the city, listening, like, how do you do it? And I've actually thought about this a lot, and for me, one of the answers is, you know, it's very important to me that my children attend public schools in Baltimore, mm-hmm. you know? And as a result, one of the results of that is I'm white. My kids are white. You know, my son is 17 years old, and he's white male. His two best friends are black females, and you know, I feel like my kids know all kinds of people, and they respect and relate to all kinds of people. And in large degree, it's because that's what they knew growing up. That's what they had every day in the school system. There's other ways to do it, I'm sure. And there's mm-hmm. other, and you know, you know, a lot of people, you know, they may think, well, you know, at Baltimore City Schools, that's, I can't do that, you know. Hey, my three kids, you know, had you know, fantastic experience in Baltimore City, because one of my kids is going to Hopkins on a scholarship. So, you know, it's people may think that you know, they don't want to go that way, right. and they get scared off by things, but you know, they don't know.
Let me jump back to the panel. I mean, don't go ahead. I just want to jump back to the panel. And Dee, you can jump in here, because I think this is an important point he's raising about our school.
I think that was a great question. So, you know, Mike said, how do we get there? There's no one big answer. It's all of us collectively following our own journeys and paths and doing what we can do to get us there. So my big thing is, like I said, is literacy. And one of my other missions, or one of the other things that I want to accomplish, is just this whole idea of reclaiming journalism. I want to, you know, I want non-traditional people, or, you know, to start to tell their stories from their neighborhoods and their communities. That's a start, right? You know, if I allow a place like Fox News to tell you how people in East Baltimore act and think and what they like, you know, then we're robbing everyone of the everything that's really going on. So, you know, I think that one person, there's not one person that can do it. And it's not one, really quick, there's not one big answer, but it's everyone doing their part, you know, collectively to make these changes. There's a quote that goes, when spiders unite, they can tie down a lion. So, you know, that's what it's going to take to happen.
And I think one of the things he said in this thing was about kids in schools. And I think you can see the difference in white kids and black kids as well. But I'm focusing on white kids here who go to Baltimore City schools, and how their view of race in the future changes because of the interactions they have in school, in a very positive sense. And I think this is a, David, a really critical point.
Yeah, I think it definitely is. And I think that, you know, raising kids in a city like Baltimore and showing them that there are all lots of different kinds of people, and that you can interact with, you know, people in a lot of different ways on a daily basis, both in school and in other venues, I think is super important. I think, you know, the issue with the quality of the school system is, you know, unfortunately a problem. But, you know, I do think that that is something that's showing some signs of improvement. I also think that, you know, like Dee was saying, it's not just going to be one answer. I mean, that's one part of the puzzle. And I think we also have to look at things that operate on a lot of different timescales. There's everything from, you know, sort of the fierce urgency of now to 30 years. You know, some of the things that we're talking about are generational things that are going to need certain people to kind of get out of the way in order for things to really move forward. And so I think, you know, all of the ideas that we can bring to the table, you know, that do operate on different timescales will get us to the place we're trying to get to ultimately, but it's going to be a little bit of a haul. You know, that said, in terms of how do we do this, you know, one of the things that I've been working really hard to do is to start to try to document in detail exactly how Baltimore is structured. And I think that one of the things that I find surprising is that when I show maps to people about how Baltimore is structured, and they, you know, we talk about where they are on the map and things like that, everybody's always surprised that they're not in the center. You know, they're always surprised to find out that they're off on one edge or the other or what have you. And they're also often very surprised to find out that the rest of the network exists the way that it does, you know, because they just kind of think that their part is the important part. The rest of it just, you know, doesn't exist. So I think, you know, there's a lot that we can do in terms of data. I think there's a lot that we can do in terms of art. I think you can generate a lot of interesting art from data. And that's one of the projects that I'm going to be looking at doing this year, is generating, you know, a project around getting people together from both ends of the spectrum and creating the kind of art that Dee was talking about, where people talk about what the common humanity is and how people are really connected, what the common denominator is. So I think all these things can move us forward.
Let's close us out here.
Yeah, I think it's a matter of, and I appreciate Mike. I really appreciate Mike, not just as a kind of a basketball player, but also as a voice when he was with the Baltimore Sun. I tend to think about these things as a matter of both concrete action, whether it's people like us trying to create space, particularly for young people, young Black Baltimoreans, to claim their city. But it's also about kind of spreading ideas and just working with a certain type of intention, right? And there is no quick bullet. There is no quick solution. There is no one hit. It's about us doing that and coming to the table with that type of approach every day, and then modeling that in ways that give other people a sense that they could do the same type of thing.
It's been great to have the three of you on. And David Troy, CEO and co-founder of 410 Labs and creator of Maelstrom, it's really good to have you back in the studio again. Looking forward to having you back a great deal more.
Yeah, thank you, Mark.
Good to have you here. And Dee Watkins back in the house, author and filmmaker, Coppin State University creative writing professor, and I think one of our up-and-coming writers in America that will explode onto the scene right out of our own community. And it's always good to have you in the studio, Dee.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
My good friend Dr. Lester Spence, author of Stare in the Darkness, Limits of Hip-Hop and Black Politics, and Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and, of course, Center for Emerging Media's Colin Russell. It's good to have you here, brother. Thank you so much.
My man, it's good to be here.
Sorry to make you all miss your game today.
Oh, we're trying to get it in after this.
Okay.
Something
gets in the way. The show is about this game, so there we are. On the way out of here, come right back with Bain and Woods in the City Paper. On the way to break, Told You So, by the great Count Basie, recorded on this day in 1976. We'll be right back with Baynard Woods to see what's happening in the City Paper. ¶¶